Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
From WABE in Atlanta, this is Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up on today's program, part two, conversations regarding Senate Bill 140, which would prohibit some surgeries and hormone therapies for transgender youth. I'll speak with a psychotherapist who says Senate Bill 140 could change how she advises her young patients and families. And also reaction from parents of trans and gender fluid kids. That's coming up in just a moment, but first, a few news headlines. Early voting is underway in Clayton County, and for the first time in more than a decade, the election for the county's next sheriff will be without Victor Hill's name on the ballot. Hill served four terms before he was found guilty of violating the rights of six detainees while they were under his supervision in the jail. Hill was sentenced Tuesday to a year and a half in federal prison. Current interim sheriff Levon Allen is running against four challengers to serve a full term. That special election is March 21st. In other news, Port of Savannah officials say more than 11% of all international containers, that's more than 2 million, were moved through its docks last fiscal year, its most ever. And there's more from Patrick Saunders.
Savannah is an export port. Goods made here are shipped out. In fact, officials recently said it was the busiest port in the country for U.S. goods handled. Those exports are made up largely of farm and factory goods sent to Europe and the Mediterranean. But as supply chain issues and economic fears remain, imports, especially from Asia, are down. Port officials continue expansion plans, including ways to bring in bigger ships with more goods, they say to be ready when that business picks back up. Patrick Saunders, WABE News.
And y'all about to get some money. Governor Brian Kemp has signed off on another round of state income tax refunds. House Bill 162 provides a one-time refund up to $250 for single filers, $375 for heads of households, and $500 for joint filers. Those refunds are expected in about 6 to 8 weeks, but requires both your 2021 and 2022 refunds to be filed. Also yesterday, it was a bill that would ban gender-affirming surgery and hormone replacement therapy for minors. It advanced through a key House committee after clearing the Senate last week. It was a packed room for the hearing as lawmakers heard from proponents and opponents of Senate Bill 140. WAB politics reporter Sam Greenglass was there, and he joins Closer Look now with all the details. Sam, welcome.
Hey there, Rose.
You've covered a lot of measures, some controversial, some pretty simple, from committee meetings to floor votes. How would you describe yesterday's public health committee meeting, Sam?
So the hearing room was just absolutely stuffed to the gills. It was at capacity. People were crowded in the hallway outside of the hearing room. There was actually an overflow room two floors below in the legislature's main office building where people could watch a live stream of the hearing. And even if you popped into lawmakers' offices around the building, you would see staff members all were kind of huddled around computers streaming this hearing on from their offices. There were like 60 people almost who were signed up to testify on the bill. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, after this vote, as people were spilling out of the hearing room, I think I've never seen so many people in tears after a committee vote, you know, parents, kids, even one lawmaker crying as this unfolded yesterday.
So as mentioned, there were proponents and opponents. Was there anything that lawmakers really spent a great deal of time on and asking or following up with some of the testimony? I know there was some actual health officials that actually testified as well.
So I think one thing that we heard Democrats really try and drill down on was asking for more data, for more scientific studies, for medical guidance to back up what was being proposed in this bill. There was this one moment when Democrat Michelle Au asked Senator Cardin Summers, who is the main sponsor of the bill on the Senate side, about this guidance from the American Academy of Pediatrics that basically says doctors should provide comprehensive and developmentally appropriate gender-affirming care. Mm-hmm. And Summers said he hadn't actually read that guidance. He was also asked about a statement in the bill that says the General Assembly finds there has been an unexplained rise in cases of kids experiencing gender dysphoria, but he couldn't point to a citation or a statistic, basically kind of saying that he's heard this anecdotally. So, you know, you really heard lawmakers trying to zero in on facts, being this is the Public Health Committee, and saying that they try and deal in evidence on some of these more prickly issues.
So, Sam, what is State Senator Cardin Summers and those who are backing this measure if they're not going to rely on data and other, you know, experts from the American Medical Association and other organizations? What are they relying on to help them push this measure?
So what they're saying is they basically want to put a pause on this process until kids are 18 and in a better position to make decisions about medical treatments that they say could have lifelong effects. And, you know, there is a limited amount of studies and research on some of these issues that they're trying to point to. But, you know, we heard on the flip side from many parents and kids themselves who have pointed to statistics that, you know, we know that trans kids have higher rates of depression, higher suicide rates. And, you know, while you've got the Republican sponsors of the bill saying, you know, we should pause this, this is something that can wait, we're hearing from students who are saying, you know, I wouldn't be alive today if not for being able to access this care. And, you know, one thing that really isn't reversible is someone who commits suicide. So that is kind of the scope of the conversation that we were hearing in committee yesterday.
Sam, was there any discussion about changes, amendments, changes, some of the provisions? Was that discussed at all?
So there was one amendment that was allowed to come up for a vote during the hearing yesterday, and it did pass. So the original bill all made it clear that doctors or healthcare providers would not be able to be held civilly liable or criminally responsible for, just reading from the original bill here, injury, death, or loss to a person for not complying with this bill. And that language was stripped out in this amendment. And so while it doesn't expressly say that, you know, doctors can be held liable with a lawsuit, it does kind of open the door for such lawsuits. One thing that has always been in the bill and remains in the bill is that doctors, healthcare providers who do not comply with it could lose their medical licenses.
Sam, gender affirming care is not just one single therapy or process. It's a lot. It's a model that includes a lot that may not even include some type of surgical procedure. Does this bill have any provisions that determine, well, if it's just therapy or counseling, or just nothing under the umbrella of gender affirming care would be allowed?
So there are two explicit pieces of this care that would not be allowed under the bill, and that is hormone replacement therapy, and then that would be gender affirming surgery, which I should note, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics, is pretty rare in adolescents. What it would still allow is puberty blockers, which is kind of earlier on in this process. And it doesn't say anything about therapy or counseling. And I think you make a good point here, which is when we talk about gender affirming care, this is, you know, not something that just like happens overnight or on the tip of a pen. You know, it starts with often many months and years of therapy and counseling with a team of medical providers before getting to something like puberty blockers, before getting to something like hormone replacement therapy, and before, in rare cases for adolescents, surgery.
We'll see.
And it also does.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I just want to say real quick, there are exceptions for other medical conditions that are not related to gender dysphoria, you know, so that's like for kids that have a chromosome mismatch or something like that. There are provisions to allow things like hormone replacement in those cases.
Sam, what about for youth who are currently already going through some type of transitional process? You can't just stop that. That would be a health issue, correct? Wouldn't that probably lead to another health issue? I know you're not a doctor, but...
So the bill does exempt people who have started a particular therapy before July 1st of 2023, but this came up, you know, in the course of questioning from a parent in public comment yesterday for, you know, say a kid who has started puberty blockers before July 1st, they wouldn't be able to move to, say, hormone replacement therapy after July 1st. So you have to have started that particular treatment before July 1st in order to continue it. You couldn't move to another phase of this treatment after July 1st if you haven't already started it.
How likely might this be taken up on the House floor?
So a few things have to happen before this becomes law. The House Rules Committee has to schedule a floor vote, and then the bill would have to be approved by the full House. I think it's really an open question what happens with it next. You know, this is not publicly been a priority for Governor Kemp, who would ultimately have to sign it. You know, unlike last year when we had a bill dealing with trans kids on school sports teams, you know, that was something that Governor Kemp mentioned in his State of the State address. This is not a primary year, unlike last year. You know, Kemp has been explicitly focused on these kitchen table issues. Mm-hmm. That being said, my sense is that there are a lot of folks within the Republican caucus who want to get this done. That makes sense, given the fury with which these bills have been introduced and passed in Republican legislatures around the country this year. You know, Governor Kemp may not have an election next year, but Republican representatives and senators in the state house certainly do. So, I think it's a real open question what happens, and we'll be watching really closely over the next 2 weeks. One thing I just want to note, though, is that because of that amendment that you brought up, this would still have to go back to the Senate side to, mm-hmm. to pass again because the bill has been changed. So several steps that have to happen before this becomes law, but sine die is about a week and a half or so from now. So we're really getting down to the wire.
Yeah. WABE politics reporter Sam Greenglass doing what he does best, solid reporting. Sam, thank you.
Thanks, Rose.
And to get all the latest news on Georgia's legislative session and the inside scoop on these bills, most important to you, just visit wabe.org/underthegolddome. And when Closer Look returns, day two of our conversations regarding this bill, Senate Bill 140 again, which would prohibit some surgeries and hormone therapies for transgender youth. I'll speak with a psychotherapist and also parents of trans and gender fluid children. You're listening to Closer Look.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
Everyone in vote in favor of the passage of Senate Bill 140 as amended, raise your hand. Everyone opposed, raise your hand. Okay, it's 10. So the bill passes as amended.
And that is the vote regarding Senate Bill 140, a bill that would ban gender-affirming surgery and hormone replacement therapy for minors. It has now advanced through a key House committee. This is Closer Look from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. As we continue with special programming now related to this controversial measure, now, opponents of Senate Bill 140 have warned this legislation could lead to damaging effects for the mental health of so many transgender youth. At yesterday's hearing, an expert within the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention cited studies that reveal gender-affirming care and treatment actually saves lives.
We know that access to gender-affirming care reduces the likelihood of suicidal impulses, ideations, and attempts. In fact, with research that was published late last year, It was found that access to gender-affirming care, including hormone therapy, reduced depressive incidence by almost 68% and reduced suicidal ideations and attempts by 73%.
Joining the program now is Katie Lycom. She's a psychotherapist and gender specialist in Decatur who works directly with LGBTQI youth and their families. Katie, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I want to begin with defining some terms for our listeners, because often I'll get emails and they'll say, I really don't know what this is. You Google something, you get all kinds of information. So if I just want to take a moment, if we could talk about gender-affirming care. What is it? What does it involve?
Gender-affirming care is care that takes the child's identity, and it's kind of exactly what it says, affirms it. Mm-hmm. You're not trying to change someone's mind. You're not necessarily trying to sway them either way, but if someone comes to you and says, I'm trans, I'm non-binary, you say, okay, you know, and that's as a mental health professional. Gender-affirming care as a medical professional would be providing puberty blockers, hormones, surgeries, or also the medical professional saying, I hear you, I believe you.
So, but there's a process before all of that. I mean, there's phases and stages, correct?
Yes.
That you work, talk to the family and the young person through?
Yes, definitely. Generally, I start seeing clients around the ages of sixth grade and above. So if a 12-year-old comes to me, I'm going to take a little bit more time with them, going to talk through the parents. We're going to have family sessions before I refer them at 12 would probably be puberty mm-hmm. blockers. And it would be a group decision of the parents and the child.
And define for our listeners gender dysphoria?
Gender dysphoria, traditionally speaking, gender dysphoria, people think of it as a negative feeling or emotion, a sadness, a discomfort in someone's sex assigned at birth and their gender identity. Mm-hmm. Gender dysphoria is also a diagnosis in the DSM. With people who feel incongruent in the sex assigned at birth. So it is both a diagnosis and a feeling.
And to your knowledge, this is, I can imagine maybe decades ago in the 50s and 60s, do we understand these terms then, or were they even talked about? Were they even around?
So these terms, as stated, were not really around. Mm-hmm. However, there were trans people. There were trans yeah. surgeries being performed. Mm-hmm. And these terms, I would say they were around, just not talked about.
When parents come to you, what are some of the typical questions they have?
Okay. Lots of times they ask me, is their child going through a phase? Have they had enough therapy? Are they ready? You know, they ask me questions about, which I try to answer in the best way possible. You know, is this something we should do? Is this going to hurt? You know, if we're talking about hormones, they want to know the risks and benefits. And as a mental health professional, I talk more about anxieties related to risks and benefits and leave the medical medical questions to the doctors. But, you know, we do talk it through.
When you are counseling families, Katie, you start with the parents, then do you speak to the child, if possible, alone? Or with the parents? Can you take our listeners through that process? And I know it may depend on the age of the person to the young person.
I was just going to say, it mostly depends on the age. Usually I actually start with the child first, because a trans child or gender expansive child might have felt this way for years before they come out to their parents. Mm-hmm. So I want to get an understanding first of how long the child has been feeling this way before I approach the parents, because they might be on completely different pages. So when we do have the family session, you know, I want to have full information from the child first.
As a trained and licensed therapist in this area, and I imagine, as you said, depending on the age, with younger kids, mm-hmm. I'm curious, are you able to, what are those questions that you ask them to determine that perhaps this is something that the parents really need to think about and talk through as a family? Mm-hmm. Or is it the kid just says, you know, I feel this way?
So with younger kids, I actually teach a course with younger kids. a lot of it is just, it's affirming. It's, you know, maybe changing pronouns, changing name, changing dress. So we're talking with the parents about, you know, how long has your child been expressing, you know, I want to be a boy, I'm a boy, I'm a girl. Mm-hmm. You know, in what ways do you see that? It's not always what toys they play with or, you know, what they ask for, because we know gender is a construct, but it's more, what is the child saying to you? What are you seeing? You know, maybe they've said something to their teacher, their preschool, and you just take, it's more observation at that age and really listening. But the thing about young kids is they're very vocal. They're very verbal. They're going to tell their parents probably more quickly than a 14-year-old will.
Yeah.
Because the 14-year-old has shame, or not shame, but the 14-year-old is worried about how their parents are going to take it. But a 3-year-old, a 4-year-old, they're just themselves.
What is a typical, I guess, timeline in terms of when a family comes to you and then the child, and everyone agrees that perhaps then it is time to consider the transitional process? Is that over a year? Is it months? Or does it really depends on the child?
It depends on the child. And as I'm doing, like if I'm assessing for hormones, it really depends on how far along in the journey they are. I don't want to gatekeep a child having access to care. So this, someone might have come to me and they were in therapy for 2 years with a clinician that wasn't affirming. So if they come to me and I know that they have a history of telling someone for a couple of years, it doesn't have to be me. So that mm-hmm. could be a very quick process. You know, I'm not, it really depends on the age and mm-hmm. where the family stands.
Those backing Senate Bill 140 say the transitioning process is something that should happen in adulthood. They believe minors should wait until they're 18 or older to make that decision. You've heard this.
Mm-hmm.
And as a licensed therapist who counsels families and young folks, what do you counter with?
You know, I was just speaking in the green room that there is self-harm among teenagers that aren't receiving gender-affirming care. There are suicidal ideations. There are suicides. And oftentimes when kids aren't receiving gender-affirming care and they come to me, you know, they'll tell me, I ask them, are you self-harming? You know, and they might not tell their parents, of course, but they tell me.
And you've had youth tell you that?
Oh, yes, yes. I've had youth tell me that before they had the courage to come out to their parents, they were self-harming. And you know, it's difficult to hear, and I know that it's because they're scared of hearing no. And I've had kids that, you know, I'm working with someone right now who's an adult who I happened to see a few years back, and they came to me and they had suicidal ideations. They were self-harming. They started on hormones around age 15, 16, mm-hmm. and have come back to me as an adult, and the transformation is beautiful. I mean, they're in college. They're, you know, they're great.
Yesterday, during yesterday's hearing, there was Atlanta-based pediatric endocrinologist Dr. Tony Kim who had this to say.
But there are a lot of children who are confused and don't necessarily know the right thing and are using this as what they think is the right solution when it's not. And unfortunately, once you do certain steps in a gender transition, you can't go back. And so the thing that I like about this bill was that it recognizes that there are going to be people who do want to transition, and that's okay for their choice, because we live in a country where people should be supported in having a different walk of life if it doesn't hurt other people. And I respect that. But I also know that there are a lot of children who are hurting, and they blame it on one thing when it's actually something else. Or there are just kids who go through phases.
Katie, your response to what Dr. Tony Kim had to say there?
I think that what Dr. Tony Kim was speaking in was not necessarily her lane. everything she said seemed to be from a mental health perspective and not necessarily a medical perspective. So when you're talking about kids going through phases, that's more of a mental health clinician's area of interest. And also, you know, I tell parents all the time, nobody actively chooses to be trans. We have Transgender Day of Remembrance coming up on March 31st to remember transgender people who have been murdered throughout the year. I don't know people who look at me and say, you know, I think it'd be fun to be trans. You know, it's difficult. Mm-hmm. So when someone tells me they're transgender, you know, I believe that because they're not just going to do that willy-nilly.
If this bill does become law, this would greatly impact how you would advise families and their children.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be difficult. You know, currently when I work with parents who say they want their children to wait until 18, you know, it's really hard to work with those kids because there's no, you know, they feel like they don't have hope. You know, when you're talking to a 14-year-old and telling them they have to wait until they're 18, that's 4 years, and that's a long time to have gender dysphoria, and that's a long time to have suicidal ideations and try to protect them for 4 years. So it's going to be hard and it's going to be difficult. And if people don't have the resources to move out of state, you know, it's just going to be trying to find them a protective bubble.
Are you already hearing from some families that you are currently working with that have concerns?
I actually had a session this morning with someone and we were talking about their plan and whether or not they had the resources to move out of state and how quickly they could do that.
What resources are available to minors and families who are right now going through this process? If this does, the only option is to seek help in another state if this does become law?
You know, I mean, it's going to come down to financial resources. Mm-hmm. And you know, can a family move out of state? Which, you know, I'm also on a board with the Chamber of Commerce, so this is going to hurt our economy. This is not just, you know.
Take that further. What do you mean?
If you have, you know, there's a number of families with trans kids in the state of Georgia, and the LGBT community contributes over $1 billion to the state of Georgia in economic growth. Mm. So when you start talking about a large community moving out of the state, this is going to hit businesses. This is going to hit the economy. And, you know, I think that we have a great film industry in Georgia. I think corporations and industries are going to look at our state.
And we've been down this road before with other legislation.
Mm-hmm.
And that likelihood. Katie Likem, psychotherapist and gender specialist in Decatur, who works directly with LGBTQI youth and their families. Katie's going to stay with us, and when we come back, we'll hear personal stories from families. This is Closer Look.
This bill would not protect children. It will do the opposite. Every single representative who votes yes on this bill will have the blood of the children of this state on their hands, who they are supposed to represent. These children are people's daughters and sons, their friends, their sisters and brothers. The absence of their lives caused by this bill would be immeasurable compared to the minuscule percentage of people who regret seeking these treatments.
That is Georgia native and Georgia State freshman Leonardo Hennett. Leonardo told state lawmakers he began hormone therapy at age 13 and had breast removal surgery at age 15. And he also said this.
These life-saving treatments is the reason that I am able to speak to you today. I would not be able to attend college. My little brother would not have someone to bother every single day. I would not be here. This bill would restrict essential care for transgender minors, care that I know is the reason that I am living today. The reality of it is this. If this bill passes, transgender kids will die.
And Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. And a programming note, as we said yesterday, Closer Look reached out to dozens of the lawmakers that sponsored and were in support of this bill. Only Cardin Summers had responded, but then stopped communicating with our producers. So we did reach out and invited them on the program. There were many personal stories heard during Tuesday's Public Health Committee regarding Senate Bill 140, and at times emotional pleas to not advance the measure, as well as proponents of the bill. Well, joining me now in our WAB studios, parents. I want to welcome to the show Sarah Price, Jonathan Smith, Lindy Grabby, and also Katie is still with us from the segment before. Thank you all for coming in and taking the time.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Sarah, I'll begin with you. Tell our listeners about Billy. How old is Billy?
Billy is fantastic. Billy is blissfully unaware. He's 7 years old, completely affirmed, and saddens me that we're here today to talk about such complicated matters that he's not even aware he's at the center of.
Jonathan, you have two kids. How old are Jonah and Clara?
Jonah and Clara are 9 and 7. Jonah was with us yesterday at the hearings. We hoped to have an opportunity to be heard, but didn't get that opportunity.
We'll talk about that in a moment. Lindy, what about Natalia?
So my daughter is 29, and she transitioned when she was 26.
Mm-hmm. Let me stay with you for a moment. Lindy, when did, is it Natalie or Natalia?
Natalia.
When did she come to you and first have these conversations?
It was around age 25, but she did tell me later on that she had thought about it some years before, over time, for a very long time. She was significantly depressed during her adolescence.
Did you recognize anything about the depression that she was experiencing then?
I didn't connect it with gender dysphoria at all. But I'm very grateful that she, when she finally decided that she had the support of the family and physicians and was able to become the happiest person I've ever seen her. Mm-hmm.
Sarah, I want to come back to you. Billy comes to you. What age was this?
Oh, gosh. Well, Billy's, the assumptions we made about gender at birth have been dispelled by him all along. As early as he could talk, he was saying, I'm not a boy or a girl, I'm a Billy. We thought, we're so progressive. Look at this beautiful creature we've made. He's not even going to claim gender. But then by the time he was aware of what gender was, he was saying, I'm a boy. And it was actually at a four-year-old pediatric appointment where, as I was leaving, my pediatrician said, you know, anything else? You want to cover anything else? And I said, oh, there's just one this thing. You know, he's 4 years old. At the time, I was using she, her pronouns. My kid is 4 years old, but maintains that they're a boy, you know, and we're just not putting too much emphasis on that, too much attention. And she lowered her glasses and she looked at me and she said, you're telling me that your child continues to tell you consistently who they are and you're disregarding it or not incorporating it into your life. Which took me way back. That can't be what we're doing. Tell me that's not what I'm doing. And she put her glasses back up and said, congratulations, you have a son. And we have been on this affirmed path ever since. So for the last 3 years.
Jonathan, two kids.
Two kids.
So
Jonah is my gender nonconforming. First presented, you know, for lack of a better terminology, at the age of 3. Enjoyed dresses, enjoyed, you know, more effeminate things. And there was a period of sort of female identity, but we've come more to rest on a they identity, mm-hmm. you know, and in our household, we're sort of supportive of take it where you want. It's a social construct, mm-hmm. you know, and live the life you want to live.
And Clara?
She occasionally, you know, reflects on Jonah's gender, and
she definitely presents as female. Mm-hmm. Every now and then she'll tell us she's a boy. There's a period of time when she was identifying as an apple, and I'm not sure that that's really apropos this dialogue per se, but you know, she was like two at that time. Yeah. So I think it's more being cognizant of Jonah, mm-hmm. and sort of looking up to Jonah as an older sibling and somebody who cares so deeply for her and wanting to, at some level, you know, understand their journey.
Katie, you've heard these journeys before.
Yes.
I want to come back to Sarah for a moment. Did you get any pushback, criticism, attacks from folks as Billy became Billy?
There has been some, I mean, of course, we've got a lot of compassionate, caring family. At different stages, we've dealt with different degrees of uncertainty, call it ignorance. For the most part, a ton of love and rallying around him to affirm who he is. Very early on, I started saying, we got to come to terms with the fact that he is not transitioning. We are. We are transitioning into awareness of who he has always been. That has been really consistent. And honestly, we have a gift to trust him as a young human being, mm-hmm. to like trust that that's been authentic all along. It's been the simplest, most natural thing in the world. So yeah, we've gotten some pushback. We've had to have some tedious conversations with family, and I am familiar with going to bat for him. This bill takes it to new levels, of course, but yeah, I mean, you know, that's part of affirming young people.
Billy is receiving some type of gender affirming care or therapy here?
Interestingly, not yet. He's 7 years old. We probably wouldn't be having those conversations reasonably for another 5 or 6 years. But I do want to say, like, after the news this morning, the first thing that I did was make an appointment for a consultation with him for gender affirming care, because there's a grandfather clause with this bill that would protect kids that are already like under the care of a provider. Mm-hmm. And to use the Republican senator's language from this bill, if we're concerned about pushing young people towards this kind of care or these, you know, irreversible, air quotes, decisions, I've never felt more pushed to make decisions preemptively for my child than I did this morning.
Lindy, I want to come back to you for a moment, because your child, first of all, always going to be your baby, even when they're 50 or 60. Do you have any feelings, I don't want to use the word regret, but that you could have maybe possibly had some type of gender-affirming care for your daughter?
It would have probably been great to have that. Mm-hmm. But really, I don't think she was ready at the time. Mm-hmm. So, and it was a little different 10 years ago. There was just, this wasn't a possibility. But I'm so I was always concerned about her depression, mm-hmm. and I think that this legislation is going to seriously put the children of Georgia at risk. Mm-hmm. It's very harmful to the children of Georgia.
Yeah, I agree forcefully with Lindy there, and I think it was best sort of represented at yesterday's hearings by Jacob Hayes, who is another young Georgian who cited the statistics in this circumstance and said, mm-hmm. look, if this bill passes, you're going to save 32 children statistically who would have regretted treatment, but you're going to condemn another 569 to death through suicide.
I would like to add that in my practice, I have seen over 1,000 people who are trans. Mm-hmm. Some of that was just for a session to write a hormone letter. And of those 1,000 people, I know of two that, you know, weren't 100% happy.
Mm-hmm. Two out of 1,000.
Two out of 1,000.
Jonathan, I want to ask you the same question that I asked Sarah in terms of support.
Sure.
Or, you know, lack of support from family or folks around.
You know, we have a really welcoming and loving family, and I mean that both in the nuclear sense of my wife and I, and extending it to our greater family. And everybody's very accepting of Jonah and the way they choose to identify, which I think further sort of supports them you know? And I think that's what we're really talking about, is how do we support children who are coming through some really difficult questions as far as the scaffolding we've received. You know, I can't speak highly enough of Dr. Bolds at Montgomery Elementary, who was really, really helpful in us sort of making sure that their curriculum was gender conscious, which is the beginnings of sort of understanding that with these, new social constructs, we need to be more appreciative of the difference of us all as people and accepting, you know?
Jonah is how old? Nine?
Nine, yeah. So Jonah is 6 years, almost 7 years, gender nonconforming. And it, in terms of the school systems, going first from Montgomery Elementary and then to Kittredge Magnet School here in DeKalb County, I've been overwhelmed by the support of the teachers and the school systems in their understanding, because this isn't an uncommon thing. You know, the kids are all right. It's the 65-year-old senator from Cordeal or the 80-year-old chairwoman crying crocodile tears for the parents that she just passed a bill on.
Is he in gender affirming care? Is it too young still? Or
we started counseling really early, and I think that's the key. What we were trying to create is just a blank canvas for Jonah to have their experience. You know, so we're not yet at a point of considering puberty blockers. We're beginning to have those dialogues, but at the age of 9, you know, that's not a care consideration that we need to conclude on as of yet.
What conversations do you have with him about this process?
With them, we have...
With them.
Oh, it's good. I appreciate your correction, as with Jonah, because that shows the acknowledgement.
And I apologize.
Right? Oh, no, yeah. There's no apology, because we know that you're here to understand. You know, you're here to create a platform for these people. And Jonah loves that opportunity to sort of discuss.
And Jonah will get a shirt. Well, all of the kids will get a shirt.
Jonah will love it. I guarantee you. We'll probably tie-dye it, but, you know, they will love it.
I love it.
Yeah.
So it's just when you have these conversations, it's
open, mm-hmm. because Jonah is a highly intelligent child. And this is something we were having a discussion in the green room about, is how many of these children are coming out of highly capable, highly intelligent, highly supported families, and what that could do to the state of Georgia if they go down the road of ostracizing and targeting those families. You know, they'll lose a lot of great, great young Georgians.
So what kind of conversations you and Billy have over there?
I was just saying this in the green room, too. It's so interesting to have additional education on the table for this kid. You know, I have I'd be remiss in not mentioning Alice, our 13-year-old, too. Mm-hmm. Billy is learning about all kinds of stuff that Alice didn't know about at 7 years old. You know, hey, buddy, you know, do you know what it means to be trans? And do you know what the opposite of trans is? The opposite of trans is cis. And so let's talk about these containers and... you know, those are the early conversations we're having, and we're doing our very best to make sure that he understands who he is so that he can just be, continually affirmed and confident in his own identity. But yeah, I mean, it's early for these conversations. Mm-hmm. You know, we weren't talking about pronouns in elementary schools 3 years ago. That's brand new, too. So pronouns is new. You know, whether you're trans or cis is new. How you identify, centering people's identities is a new concept. Mostly I'm joyful about that, and I'm celebrate that we can do that with him and with our whole family. But yeah, that's new. It's young.
Lindy, I want to come to you for a second, because when we talk about the importance of, listen, we always talk about representation. You know, I'm here because of folks like Zernona Clayton and other folks, you know, who I looked up to as a journalist. And when you think about in terms of representation for the Billies and Jonas and what your daughter now can talk to, because there's a big gap. There's a gap there in terms of the age. You see, we've come a long way, but still a long way to go in terms of, because Sarah just talked about acceptance, and we're all transitioning to how we need to work with and accept and be loving, since that's what we're all supposed to be doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you think about the age gap between your daughter and someone like Billy and how far we've come, what do you think about?
Well, you know, it means there's progress, that humankind is progressing.
I'm mystified by this interference with the rights of families and with the rights of healthcare providers. I'm a healthcare provider.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just kind of stunned that this is coming from conservatives who are so vehement about protecting the rights of families. You know, I think we're all learning, but I think we at least need to be open to understanding ourselves in different ways. And I'm talking really about rural folks and families where maybe not college educated and not mm-hmm. exposed to some of the trends.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? Every single family across the entire country has issues around mental illness, substance use. And this is just one of those things that's going to happen to families, all families. There's going to be somebody in the family.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you're legislating to prevent them from becoming who they are, then that's so dangerous.
Katie, I have a listener who says, how do you even know where to begin to find a qualified therapist, and is it expensive?
So, first of all, I want to say that while therapy can be expensive, there are resources. There's a website called Open Path Collective, mm-hmm. and there are therapists that have basically promised that they would give a certain number of sliding fee scale sessions.
Open Path Collective?
Open Path Collective. That is one resource. And how do you find a therapist? I search gender therapists near me.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can go to websites like Therapy Den or Psychology Today. I will say it is very easy to check a box that says that you work with transgender people.
Mm-hmm.
So I would suggest that people read through their profiles and see how much they mention the trans community and how passionate they speak about mm-hmm. the trans community to find the most affirming providers.
And as we wrap up, if there's one thing you want folks to take away, whether it's your personal experience or just your own personal ideology about all of this. And Katie, I'll start with you. What do you say to our listeners?
You know, I was raised conservative, and I didn't know anyone who was trans until around 2010. And when I met her, I guess my whole life changed. You know, I just want people to know that first they do know someone who's trans. There's no way they don't. And second, if you just look at the community, you will see such beautiful people that need to be protected. And, you know, I'm sure, like you said, every family has someone who's trans. So please don't work against your family.
Jonathan?
I'd say my takeaway is just love your child. You know, if you love and support your child, you're doing the right work. We all know as parents, you can have every idea about how your child is going to live their life, all the roadblocks you're going to remove, and how you're going to make them who you want them to be. But we end up concluding that our life path is to support our children for who they are, never who we want them to be.
Sarah?
Oh, man. You know, I think my overarching thought right now is I want to just be able to do all of the hard work that is inherent in parenting these two young people. I want to be waking up every day thinking about the already challenging opportunities to genuinely support them. And I don't want to be wasting time and energy and my resources on fighting legislation that restricts them.
Lindy.
I feel like the program yesterday at the Capitol was very biased, very unscientific, and it's very disheartening. If any of those folks that are supporting this legislation had a child that was trans, they would be like us. All you care about is you want your child to be happy. You want your child to be okay, and they would change their tune very, very fast.
You okay, Sarah?
It is a really sad day. It's a sad day in Georgia. And I just hope that I hope we can get right on the right path to supporting kids in earnest and not with political bullets.
I would tell you what I told Jonah yesterday after witnessing that hearing. And we've lost a battle. But we only lose this war when we stop fighting.
Yeah.
Jonathan, Sarah, Lindy, Katie, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. I hang out with Billy and Claire and John. They sound like some fun kids.
They are. Anytime.
Welcome.
If they like ice cream, let's go.
Come let's on do through.
It. Come thank on you, through. Rose.
Thank you all for coming and sharing
thank
your stories.
You so
I really
much.
Appreciate
thank
it.
You so much for having me.
Yes, thank you.
And that's it for this edition of Closer Look. Our producers are LaShawn Hudson and Daniel Razel. Our supervising producer is Tiffany Griffith. Our engineer is Sawyer Vanderwerth. A reminder, let us know your thoughts on today's program or any other. Send me an email, rose@wabe.org, as y'all love to do. If you missed any of today's program, it's online at wabe.org/closerlook. And of course, Closer Look weeknights at 7 p.m., as well as in our podcast. So subscribe to Closer Look wherever you like, because it will be free. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE. Out of Atlanta, I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WABE politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WABE politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WABE.org or your favorite podcast platform.